This webcast discusses how communities can more effectively manage rainwater and snowmelt where it falls. Green streets can make great places, preserve water quality, and restore our nation's waterways. These and other practices, including rain gardens, curb cuts, bioswales, and green roofs, are helping many urban communities like Portland, Seattle, and Chicago address stormwater runoff as well as provide great aesthetic benefits. In addition, green streets and other environmentally friendly landscape designs can help minimize urban heat island effect, reduce a community's carbon footprint, and cool the planet. Join us for this webcast to learn how your community can incorporate more green designs into long-term urban and transportation planning. Clark Wilson, the lead speaker for this webcast, presented the same topic as a podcast. Visit epa.gov/OWOW, that's O-W-O-W, /podcast, P-O-D-C-A-S-T-S, to listen to the podcast. Now let's meet our speakers. Our first speaker, Clark Wilson, is a senior urban designer for the Smart Growth Program within the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. He is an urban designer with the Development, Community, and Environmental Division at EPA. This division is responsible for the agency's smart growth work. Clark's area of focus in the division is ecologically sustainable development with a specific concentration in advancing the transportation, livability, and environmental goals of smart growth in street design. Our second speaker is Ellen Greenberg. Ellen Greenberg is an urban planner working at the complex intersection of land use, transportation, and urban design. Her independent consulting practice provides planning, research, and education services to public, private, and nonprofit clients. Ellen's research on sustainable streets is sponsored by the UC Davis Sustainable Transportation Center, where she is visiting practitioner in 2008. Now that I've introduced our speakers, let's get started. Clark, take it away.
Okay, thank you very much. I actually have a little bit of an entourage in the room here to react to some of my speaking because I'm still not used to talking into a screen here. I'd like you to advance to slide number 2 right now. That is my cover slide. And I would again like to send greetings. I reviewed the participant list and I saw many familiar names and I sort of asked, why are they listening to me again? But I can only imagine you're here to hear Ellen afterwards, who has a lot of interesting content in that. Advance to slide number 3, please. This quote here by Anne Winston-Spern sort of provides the philosophical underpinning, and so while I explain what I'm going to be talking about the next 40 minutes or so, you can ponder these thoughts that she is putting down in this quote. What I'm going to be doing today is just providing the basic principles, how I've worked with them on what a green street is and how it ties to the smart growth effort. I'm going to then discuss what those efforts are that are being undertaken specifically in our Office of Smart Growth here at the EPA. Then we're going to look at some preliminary excellent examples coming from Portland, which I'm sure all of you are probably aware is a laboratory for a lot of these best practices. And then Ellen, in her presentation, will have a lot more case study examples. And then I'm going to be finishing up with could you imagine ... type of slides. So let's get started here. Slide number 4, okay, no comment. I think this sort of embodies a lot of the issues that I'm going to be talking about. And as you can imagine, this is a serious problem with how a lot, it was an exacerbation, I should say, of a problem that a lot of streets have. This is a single-family residential street. If you just note the width of that, and so you can imagine that, there's a lot of impervious surface there, which probably requires that they have a catch basin the size, which you can see is very sensitively incorporated into the sidewalk there. So you're having some ADA issues there. But this slide also talks about the topic of regionalism and about how a lot of the examples that we're going to be seeing today really need to address the specific characteristics of the place in which they are. We've been sort of brought up with this kind of curb and gutter approach that everything works everywhere. But with green infrastructure, it's really, you have to be more sensitive to the site. You have to be sensitive to the rainfall characteristics. You know, obviously the rainfall in Portland or in Maine is going to be different than here in Arizona, where their annual rainfall falls in 1 hour or such. And also, you know, understanding that you have to be more sensitive to issues of soil characteristics. And working with the landscape and not against it is one of the major tenets of green infrastructure. So advance to slide 5. And here's just some very simple points. The definition that I use for a green street. As mentioned, it incorporates green infrastructure. And this is a non-mechanical, landscape-based approach to treating stormwater runoff. And this landscape-based approach then obviously embraces the natural processes of allowing water to be detained, be infiltrated, be evapotranspirated off of plant leaves and such like that. And so there, through it, there's this maximizing of water reuse. And so the bigger idea there is that it's stormwater as an asset and not as a hazard that has been so often used, that you want to sort of flush and forget, get rid of right away, but actually using it for its full advantage. It also provides these livability goals, which is what I'm going to be relating to a lot of the other EPA efforts that we have. Not only does it improve water quality, but it's a way of using land more efficiently. The idea then that you don't have to put aside 1 acre in the corner of a development for a large detention pond, where you can actually then disperse all the treatment throughout the neighborhood or the development, that will actually improve the street characteristics. As well as provide for a more efficient land use. Solutions have to be cost effective, and again, this is achieving where you're working again with the natural conditions and not against them. And as an urban designer, what I think is most important, well, equally important as the rest I should say, is that they create these unique and attractive, memorable communities and neighborhoods. So again, supporting the livability goals of communities. Now, Green Streets is also part of the smart growth strategy. Excuse me, I'm just drying out here. Specifically, I would direct you to this work that has been completed about 2 years ago by our office, and it would be available at www.epa.gov/smartgrowth and in the publications section there. And it really makes this connection between how smart growth development can improve water and protect water resources by increasing density, so building where it's appropriate and not where it's inappropriate, improving transit and pedestrian accessibility, so relying less on the automobile and all its associated pervious surface and parking spaces. Promoting infill and development, again, increasing density where it should be and not out in the hinterlands. And then all importantly, but very difficult sometimes, is bridging institutional barriers, letting professionals getting out of their silos and actually working together. So if you move to slide number 7, then, this is a slide that our office uses a lot to talking about smart growth and water quality. And on the left, you know, here's one of a seemingly very sort of bucolic, somewhat development. And you know, from the outset, it looks like it could really treat water quality, stormwater runoff quite effectively. But then, let's be reminded, though, on the right, the slide on the right, is what's going to be often associated with this type of development. So pretty much all the, you know, pervious surface that you have on the left is going to be, like, taken out when you consider just all that impervious surface that's associated with the development on the right. So advance to slide 8. And this is part of that research in the document that I showed there. And the key to this is looking at the watershed. And that, yes, again, you know, the impervious surface cover looks rather, you know, small, and the runoff being less if you only have one development on a one-acre site. But let's start thinking about this as looking at a per-household basis then. And so you can see then in scenario A, B, and C, where you move up to a density of 8 units per acre, which is not high-rise development by any means or anything like that. This is just, you know, basically mid to small lot type of development. You can see that the runoff per unit is considerably lower as you move up into the 8-acre scenario, scenario C. Advance to slide 9. Okay, so let's start taking this up into the watershed. So again, looking at it at a different way. Imagine the amount of land that's going to be required to take care of scenario A as compared to scenario B and C. So a different way of kind of visualizing this. And then advance to slide 10. And then you can see how this works at a watershed basis. So for scenario A, you're basically taking up two watersheds. Scenario B, half of one, and then obviously in scenario C, with this more smart growth approach of more compact, mixed-use, walkable developments and such, you are preserving much of the rest of the watershed. Okay, advance to slide 11. What we're also doing in our office is quite a few technical assistance work, and two of the most pertinent are the Northern Kentucky Sanitation District Green Infrastructure Toolbox that the workshop was just completed in April. And this is actually a very interesting one because Northern Kentucky Sanitation District was under a consent decree from the EPA, and if any of you know what that is, then you know how serious an issue it is. It's basically they have a combined sewer which during wet weather events has been overflowing. And so this has meant that a lot of pollutants have been discharged into the Ohio River. And so they are under a consent decree from the EPA that has to get this cleaned up. This was similar to what Portland was several years ago, and they had to invest, I believe, almost $1 billion in large underground receptor storage. Well, in this case, the sanitation district number one was allowed for the first time by the EPA to address their issues through a watershed approach. So incorporating green infrastructure practices to address this combined sewer overflow issue. And so in the next few months, we're actually going to have that toolbox ready for publication, and it will be available on our website. There's a similar stormwater design handbook done for Sussex County last year, and that too is being developed in-house right now. I'm going through the review channels. Next week, I'm actually going off to the city of Denver. They're beginning what they're calling a livable streets initiative of how to incorporate complete streets into some of their major corridors, and also into bringing in this idea of ecological sustainability. And then also even Caltrans, the world's largest road building agency, has gotten into thinking that they need to start incorporating what they're calling smart mobility into their practices. And this, you know, this may or may not start relating closely to sort of any sort of in-street, green streets approach, but it definitely, in terms of conservation of land and such like this, have some importance. A couple other projects I just want to mention while we're on this slide, and it's something that Ellen will probably mention later, is that Ellen is part of an ICF team, and we're putting together for an implementation of Green Streets project, and we have your names and numbers, and we might be contacting a lot of you, because what we want to do is start understanding where are the significant barriers to putting together a Green Streets program, and specifically identify those places that actually do have a successful program, and what did they do that was so effective? How did they fund it? How did they organize their agencies around it? So you're going to probably hear more about that in the coming year. And then also tomorrow, UC Davis, Ellen working at UC Davis, and myself, we're completing our first peer-to-peer seminar series. We've had different cities present their programs on a weekly basis, and allowing city staff from Chicago, San Francisco, Seattle, Washington, D.C., and Portland to actually share their experiences over line. We think that this is really important in order to share this knowledge. Okay, we're going to move to slide number 12. So if the consent decree was about the combined sewer overflows, the MS4 permit framework that our office has now been working with the Office of Water here for permitting, the MS4 is Municipal Separate Storm Sewer System. So this is where you have your sanitary and your storm sewer separated. And now this is for these are for the smaller communities, less than 50,000, and developing more permit language that can actually incorporate some of the green infrastructure principles that I have been discussing. And that is really trying to mimic the hydrological cycle by using infiltration, reuse, and evapotranspiration. So advance to slide number 13. And so currently there are discussions now with the states of West Virginia, Tennessee, and Oregon about possible ways to incorporate this into their permits and programs. And several other states have also expressed some interest in exploring this option as well. So we think this is quite an exciting time. Advance to slide number 14. Our office currently is working on smart growth and emergency response issues, and so this ties directly into issues of narrower streets and the often heard question or comment is, what about the fire department? What about the fire code? And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here. Suffice to say that we're trying to look at ways of coordinating with emergency responders, and that's not just the fire department, because actual fire calls only constitute 7% of total emergency EMT calls. So that's only 7% are related to fire. Many more are actually related to high-speed collisions. So if you can sort of understand the link there about the wider streets, do have some safety issues related to them. So at this point, we're just trying to find commonalities to work with, and that's just a list of some of what we're doing in that study right now. But again, I don't have a lot of time to go into details of that. But look for a publication of that sometime next year. Advance to slide 15. Now, school siting and safe routes to school. Okay. You think I might be stretching this a little bit in relating, but what I really want to do with this is discuss here about the livability and walkability goals being achieved in the community and how you can actually achieve them through a Green Streets approach. Because a lot of these principles and a lot of these facilities, shall we say, or designs that you're going to be seeing in some of the case studies really start to support safe, walkable, enjoyable streets. As well, and there's some examples that have been happening in Portland, and I believe some in Los Angeles, where the school sites themselves are actually being tied into the street network, and actually rain gardens being built on the schools' sites themselves that start to deal with some of the runoff from adjacent streets that have been leading to flooding issues. There's a very nice example in Portland of this, but unfortunately time precluded me from showing that one. Advance to slide number 16. The ITE, the Institute of Transportation Engineers context-sensitive streets. I'm going to have to drink some more water here. This is then a document that I would say helps to find that space in the right of way to start to incorporate some of these green elements. And it looks at how to design streets that are more, as the title would suggest, more sensitive to the neighborhoods in which they are running. Do you really need 12-foot wide travel lanes in a busy mixed-use corridor? Probably not. Within a finite amount of right-of-way, those extra feet that you pick up can become very valuable in establishing space for some of the facilities that you're going to be seeing soon. And advance to slide 17. Our office is also working on model smart growth codes. And part of that is really looking at how to incorporate green infrastructure and how to help communities get a lot of these ideas into their codes and standards. I've read so many city policies from all over the country that sound great. You know, they want to be ecologically responsible. They want to be pedestrian friendly. You know, I often say, you know, those are the ones that also will say, and everyone gets a pony. You know, it's very happy. But then when you look at the actual codes, they're still from the 1950s. So basically, you know, everything that they're saying in their policies under their existing codes and standards would be illegal. So it's really important then to get the codes updated to reflect the current values of the public. Advance to slide 18, and it appears to be blank. There we are. Sorry. Hit it again if you need to. This is one of those animation slides. This is LEED ND. And for those of you that aren't acquainted with it, it's in the pilot stage right now. It's LEED for neighborhood design. So it's looking at not just how to design a specific building to be more environmentally sensitive, but it really takes in this idea of location, about context, about neighborhood, and part of that is giving points to innovative ways of treating stormwater runoff. So again, this is in the pilot stages right now with the USGBC, and our office is on a committee working with that right now. So advance to slide number 19, and this is what I'm just going to call infiltration 101. I see that there's a real mix of professions out there listening, so I'm not going to get too complicated here, because it's really hard to get complicated. Infiltration is really not rocket science. Again, it's just allowing water to soak into the ground as close to where it falls as possible, and working as much as you can with that the existing soil, and in cases where it's not as permeable, possibly doing an under drain, or one would argue that, you know, if it's really not infiltrative soils, then maybe you need to look at another option of like water harvesting or conveyance to another location or something. The takeaway message here is like one size does not necessarily always fit all. And again, this kind of flies in the face of the sort of the way we've been thinking about the homogenized curb and gutter. But again, being sensitive to the environment. So now we're advanced to slide number 20. We're going to go through some of these examples from Portland. And I know some people kind of roll their eyes and say, oh, yeah, Portland, we always hear about Portland. But I really think it's important that we give credit where credit is due. The people I talk with in the city, they've had to deal with the same engineering folks, the same traffic engineers, the same planners and such that have been resistant to trying anything new. But because of people in leadership positions there and the general public, they've actually been able to get through some of these impressive pilot projects. And so I just want to make sure that we recognize their efforts. And again, Ellen is going to be talking about some examples from other places as well. But this is a very well-known design, and I'm sure you've probably seen it before. And if you it's simply putting in infiltrative rainwater gardens that also are tree planting pits that are designed to work with on-street parking, so people can still get out of the car and not tumble into the infiltration basins there, and it still provides an ADA accessible right of way. In the top left photo, you can see that on the left. So it still has all the it provides all the transportation function that a street should. But then it also has this other element of beauty and of ecological function. So advance to slide number 21, and you can see the before and after. So there was actually a landscape strip there, not an overly attractive one, and probably one that wasn't dealing much with runoff, but how that has been incorporated into the how these rainwater gardens have been incorporated into the street design, and then you get a more attractive streetscape like the one on the right. Advance to slide number 22. This principle, although much simpler idea, has been incorporated into some of the streets in San Francisco. These were streets that were prone to flooding issues, and there was a resident there, Jane Martin, who actually started a nonprofit group called Plant SF. That was basically getting really kind of ticked off and realizing that when the streets flooded there, the ground underneath the pavement was dry. And so they've actually worked with the city in developing a permit program that would allow a lot of the sidewalk space to the pavement and the sidewalk space to be ripped up and to be planted with more drought-tolerant species of plants, rock gardens, basically improving the permeability. And the flooding conditions in this neighborhood have significantly improved. And it, you know, it was nothing more than just kind of removing, there was no underpipes, there was no drain pipes underneath, it was just the removing of pavement. Advance to slide number 23, it's probably hidden behind one of the pictures there. This is back in Portland, and this is now on a residential street. Where that was more of a commercial street that we were looking at, and the other Portland one. Here's one where simple curb extensions, or what we would call traffic chokers, were incorporated. And traffic chokers, from a traffic calming perspective, are just those that are put on at the ends of the street to basically provide a gateway, slow cars down. The design here in this residential street was to take that same idea but give it this ecological function. Allow water to flow through, working with the slope of the streets. Advance to the next slide, please. Slide number 24, you can see there. And then going through an infiltrative process. And on the picture on the right, you can see the installation of that right now. When it was installed. These have become very popular. More neighborhoods are interested in installing them. It's brought together a lot of neighborhoods who become stewards of this. They provide some of the tending to the landscape. But they're also finding that the actual maintenance required by the city is fairly minimal. It's going in there and just taking out some of the sediment at the mouth there. And scraping that down and taking about 5 minutes to do that. And so very, very low-tech solution to problems. And there, slide number 25, you can see how this can really start to improve the aesthetics of this neighborhood. Advance to slide number 26. Again, so here are some examples from elsewhere. You know, the simple curbless, unassuming kind of the street in Pleasanton, California there, same principle is being used. Or even up in Wells, Maine, where we were involved in a technical assistance project 2 years ago, using aesthetic from that was indicative of that area, what I call cultural cues, the idea of using stone walls, but it's actually a sunken stone wall that provides some of the provides one side of what we would consider a swale here, and then real sort of crafting care in the building of the rest of that infrastructure. So really kind of incorporate it into the character of the street, and again, having this ecological function to it. Advance to the slide number 27, and I'm not sure how this is looking on your screen here, but I'll be looking at some more photos of this later. This is actually Sandy Boulevard in Portland, and this is a high-volume street. That was one of those streets that cut across a grid, and so there were several of these like sort of remnant pieces of land that they were able to take and develop into rainwater gardens that were handling the sheet flow from the street. So advance to slide number 28. Some examples of these gardens here that otherwise these were just barren pavement, sort of no man's land. Advance to slide number 29. Some examples of these other rain gardens here. And here, you know, a lot of people are going to be talking about costing. And this is actually anecdotal evidence of cost savings in that they, in places like this, since there was some localized flooding in some of these areas, and they did a cost comparison about what it would take to actually rip up and enlarge some of the pipes or put in new pipes, or to start to remove some of the impervious surface, replace it with these gardens. And they found that the cost savings for the green infrastructure approach were much higher than that of going into the pipe approach. But for those of you who really need to have a cost number associated, I was provided by Nebu Nang Associates the sum total of $25 a square foot for these type of rain gardens that you've seen in the previous Portland examples. So there you go. You have a hard number. And one other note on this, and this also comes from discussions with Portland folks, is that it's a cautionary tale. You've got to get all the disciplines in together. Get your Parks and Rec group together, your landscape architects, your transportation engineers early on, and coordinate them early, because that's going to provide a lot of cost savings. Because backtracking, when you're like 50% through design and backtracking, very expensive. And then the final example, I have about 5 minutes left here, is one that looks at an entire neighborhood and how it's been retrofitted. And this is the New Columbia neighborhood in Portland. And you can see the underlying, the sort of the beigey road system that was there before, kind of the loops and lollipops that we say, were replaced by an interconnected system of streets and roads that provide better accessibility and connectivity between this neighborhood and the adjacent neighborhood. And advance to slide number 31. And then within these new street designs, over 100 pocket swales, like the ones these curb extensions were incorporated, 30 flow-through planter boxes. And so for this entire neighborhood, 98% of its stormwater has been retained on site. So a significant savings there. Advance to slide number 32. This is some before and after shots of work that we've done in Covington, and these are what I'm calling the just imagine what if, and this is work completed by Kevin Perry. And so you see where there's a really significant impervious surface here again. But just imagining, if you double click on each of these slides, you'll see the after slides materialize. What could be done? Advance to slide number 33. We have other examples here of how to again incorporate these tree planter boxes into more of a connected system, a swale system. And how it can be incorporated into the adjacent neighborhood. Slide number 34, again, sort of before and after shots here, so you might have to double-click here to get them both showing. again, this is where the ITE journal or ITE guidance will come in, and putting the roads on a diet, you know, and finding out where there is opportunity to start in incorporating some bicycle lanes, you know, like looking at the street and looking at the specific travel patterns there. Does it really carry that much traffic? Does it warrant two lanes of traffic, or is one fine with a bicycle, and then using that other space for some green infrastructure techniques? Number 35, looking out at some of more of the low density options here, heavier artillery, arterials. I should drink some more water here. And again, achieving the goals of improved access for bicycle and pedestrians, as well as achieving these environmental goals. So I hope you're all kind of getting the story that I'm telling here. So you'll make one design and get as maximum benefit as possible from it. So slide number 36, again, does that sidewalk really, really, really need to be that wide? Probably not. It's important to have sidewalks, and I'm by no means saying that we should get rid of sidewalks. But, you know, let's do something else with that piece of public right-of-way, with that piece of the pedestrian realm that actually has this other function. Slide number 37, before and after of, again, going through your cities and looking at those kind of unused spaces. This is, again, in Covington, Kentucky, where we were doing our technical assistance work. And Kevin Perry went through there and just, you know, and he was able to see that there was an adjacent parking lot that had this angled parking, and that there was this unused space there that could be then incorporated to start to handle the runoff, in this case, for the parking lot itself. And then by doing so, improving the aesthetics between the sidewalk and the parking lot, because as we all know, walking next to a parking lot, especially on hot days, not a very pleasant experience. And we have one more of these. I just like showing these off because I think this really kind of gets the creative juices flowing. Again, replacing that mass impervious surface with facilities that actually improve transportation function for bicycle and pedestrians, and have this environmental overlay as well. So then to the last and final slide, this is sort of bookending with another sort of philosophical bent here. And I really like this a quote by Bruce Ferguson, because it really talks about how you know, again, solving these issues that are very important to us right now, and we have to, you know, they're becoming law, but how to take advantage of that and really start linking our cities and our developments to natural processes, and just improving both the natural conditions and our cities, which, as I said at the very beginning, we shouldn't think of as separate anyways. And then on this, too, just I have a few minutes left. Challenges? There are a few. And typically I show here a cartoon that I like to show, but I was told that because of copyright restrictions I can't show it. I'm now a federal government employee, so I have to work under certain rules. But it essentially shows an urban sidewalk being ripped up, and just a myriad of pipes and utilities, just a maze of them beneath the ground. And you look at that and you think, yeah, in retrofit conditions, that is a real significant issue, because a lot of times you don't really know where those utilities are. And the poor trees, you know, they kind of have to be secondary. They get planted where there's kind of leftover space somewhere. And, you know, and certainly don't let them, you know, get in the way of parking meters or things like that. So this is requiring this kind of paradigm shift of giving as important due to green infrastructure as you would any other utility, and then designing with that in mind. And oftentimes in cities now, like San Francisco, for instance, a lot of their storm drain pipes, they're of terracotta, and they're 100 years old, and they're failing. And so there's going to have to be some sort of full-on redoing and retooling of the infrastructure system. So look at that as an opportunity to start incorporating these. And so you think about all this infrastructure as one. And then also what I'd like to say is that there really are no villains in this story. I think it's often, you know, stormwater engineers or traffic engineers, they get their finger pointed at them, and I think that's a little unfair. In the past, they have been charged with one issue. In the case of traffic engineers, they've been charged with move traffic. In the stormwater engineers, they've been charged with move water. And they've done that very, very effectively. So the questions now, or the or you know, what they need to be told, or you know, the issue has to be reframed. And these professionals are very, very smart people. So let's give them another problem to solve. And I think that that's where a lot of this innovation can come out. So with that, I would just like to say, you know, let's reframe the issues. Let's be more inclusive of these types of facilities. And I would hope that if I came on here in two more years, that we'd see a lot more very interesting case studies out there. So with that, I am going to pass it back over.
Thank you, Clark. We will pause here briefly to take some questions if you move to slide number 40. But first, I would like to apologize on behalf of the Watershed Academy webcast team if some of you have been experiencing technical difficulties. The webcast server was subject to an attack just before we got started. It should be fixed now, but if you are having troubles seeing the PowerPoint slides, you need to refresh the page, and hopefully that will fix the problem. So now, with that being said, we're going to move on to questions, and we'll begin with those submitted online. Just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on that question mark button at the top of the slides page. Our first question comes from Anne in Maryland, and the question is, how does a community get started in making green streets? Should they revise their codes? Should they do a demonstration project?
First of all, I'm a little freaked out that we were attacked, but you'd think there'd be other things that they'd want to, whoever does it would want to attack than a green street. Anyways, so what can you do to get a green streets program started? Well, oftentimes it is a grassroots effort, you know, really making it known to policymakers and decision makers that there's some sort of dissatisfaction with the way things are now, and that you want to have improvements to your streets. Yes, the code revisions are going to be very, very important, but I would actually suggest that you start on a smaller scale and start with some sort of demonstration project. There's examples there that we showed in Portland. The city of Chicago, even though a very large city, they're starting with a Green Alleys program. They're kind of starting small with sort of low volume, smaller network streets of alleys, and they're going to start incorporating these into those. So it's kind of the low-hanging fruit approach. And then see what happens. See if there's going to be lessons learned. And, you know, don't freak out if things don't work out right away with the first project. Learn from it and then advance it. Learn then how the codes then need to be changed. So I would say start with a demonstration and then work your way up to getting the policymakers to change codes.
Great. Our second question comes from Susan in New Jersey. Why has Portland, Oregon done so much with green infrastructure?
Well, Portland, you know, has had this history of being, you know, on the forefront of a lot of planning issues. And But that's not just because I personally don't think it's just because it's all the feel-good thing. They have real issues with water qualities and issues of endangered species in their creek system. They have coho salmon and steelhead trout, which are listed in the endangered species list. And so they have to be very careful about the water quality going into their receiving streams because they could be charged on a takings issue, that they're taking habitat away. And then also, they've learned this big lesson too about this, their combined sewer overflow, and that they've, had to incorporate this massive infrastructure, to take care of some of those, to take care of all that overflow, as I said, those big, huge interceptor tunnels. So I think they've kind of learned their lesson that it really costs a lot if you don't start thinking from a watershed approach. And I think there's just been some really enlightened leadership and some great designers there, too, that have shown how beautiful it can be, and then that just sort of picks up the momentum.
Thank you. Our next question comes from David in Rhode Island. Do you have suggestions or examples for how communities can identify overlapping benefits of green streets?
I think, a lot of those just imagine if type of slides that I was showing there. And, just putting all the pieces together and saying, put in a tree lawn or, a strip of trees, what is that going to do as far as water interception? Okay, and that also improving the pedestrian realm. Now, what if we start putting in stormwater infiltration pits there that we saw that have the street trees growing out of them? Then that starts to take the stormwater overflow. Again, it starts providing opportunities for increased aesthetics in the community, improved pedestrian realms. So I think once you start sort of thinking about all the benefits that you want in your streets, I think even if you're not a designer, you can start to sort of imagine how working together you can, or working with all those goals together, you could probably come up with a pretty cool design.
Our next question comes from Kristen in Oklahoma. Why should a city focus on green infrastructure for streets instead of for new developments or other properties?
Oh, I'm not saying that there should be one over the other. The focus of my interest here is actual green streets because they are a networked public realm. A lot of times we look at really, really wide streets and we think, oh my God, that's terrible. Those are so wide. But I kind of look at them and think, wow, that's a lot of public space there. And there's a lot of opportunities to do a lot of things within that right away. So by no means am I saying that focusing on the streets doesn't mean that you don't have to focus on new development.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Nina in California. Can you do green streets with infiltration in places with poor draining soils?
Well, again, as mentioned, I'm imagining that a lot of the soils in California that you're talking about that I'm aware of in the San Francisco Bay Area are these clay soils. And actually, clay soils do actually have some infiltration capacity. But then there are possibilities of in really confined situations of doing under drains. And I know that this is contentious with several folks. Because it doesn't really necessarily reduce the volume of water, and that leads into issues of hydromodification, where you're not actually reducing the flow into receiving bodies, and so you can still sort of scour things out. But I think there are opportunities, and then if it's like hard panned, then as I said earlier, then an infiltration basin is just not the right approach. And maybe it should be one of more detention or one of water harvesting or, conveyance through a swale or something like that that can allow it to evapotranspirate or take it to another location where there is possibility of infiltration. So again, you know, even though really focused on infiltration, again, not one size does not fit all.
Great, thank you. Our next question comes from David in Arizona. What would you recommend for an arid region like Phoenix, where we can receive 2 to 3 inches of rainfall in less than an hour and no other rainfall for the rest of the year?
Yes, that is actually, I've been in contact with a researcher that I know that they're looking at options in arid environments. And a lot of the options looking at there relate to water harvesting. And I did actually a lot of work in Phoenix. And so I know sort of the ramifications of doing detention on site in places like Arizona. And as I mentioned before, you know, you do get that massive rainfall all at once. And you sort of, you see these like very deep detention basins between the public sidewalk and the development there. And not the most comfortable walking environment. But then I've actually seen some innovative building designs where they've incorporated cisterns into the development, so they're handling their roof runoff, and the cisterns itself become part of the architecture. So I would say that a water harvesting approach is probably going to be one that is more applicable in these arid climates. But it is something, as I said, that I'm interested in researching further, because we would like to see how this can this kind of green infrastructure approach can work with all different ecosystems.
Yeah, it looks like we have one more question from those submitted online, and this question comes from Amy in North Carolina. Who maintains all of these vegetated systems that are in the right-of-way? Do the city or town employees take this over?
It depends on the location. In some of the smaller residential streets, like the ones that you saw in Portland, you have neighborhood groups taking care of them, so there is a stewardship. Along the Sandy Boulevard there, the Parks and Rec Department actually take care of those gardens, which sort of makes sense because they're the plants people. You know, the transportation folks don't deal that much with the plants. And then this is also where this kind of bridging institutional barriers has to come in, and that, again, trying to, you know, having value to the tree, having value to the plants, that they are worthy of having a true maintenance program. And I can tell, you know, horror stories from several places around the country that, you know, really do not have a maintenance program. Because there's really, it's not on the radar screen about the true benefits that the trees and plants have in being a piece of infrastructure. And so my feeling is that within the public realm, that it should be on the larger streets, that it should be the responsibility of another body. And who that is, not. Maybe it hasn't been formed yet in several city departments.
Thank you, Clark. And it does look like we have time for one question from the phone lines. So at this time, I'm going to ask anyone on the phone line who might have a question to please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before you ask the question.
Brad.
Are there any questions?
Cindy, City of Modesto.
Brad.
I have a technical question about one of the slides back early on. There's a couple of figures there that show some houses and the density there. I'm wondering, in the runoff and the impervious cover, was that including only the hardscape associated with the house, or is that also including the streets and roads and that sort of thing?
For this study, it was including the hardscape associated with the actual dwelling. But you can imagine, though, that there would be a larger association of driveways and roads with the more dispersed development that is being shown.
Thank you.
Thank you, Clark. At this time, before we move on to our next section of today's presentation, I'm going to ask that everyone please move with me to slide number 41. The Watershed Academy webcast team will be taking a much welcomed vacation in August. Don't worry, however, we will be back in September. Please visit the Watershed Academy webcast webpage at epa.gov/watershedwebcasts, that's all one word, for more information about future webcasts. At this time, we will move on to our final section of today's presentation. So, Ellen, please unmute yourself and take it away. Ellen, go ahead and hit that little code that we practiced.
Hi, everyone. This is Ellen Greenberg. Clark, that was a great presentation and a good starting point for the material I'm going to present on sustainable streets. And my presentation is titled Emerging Priorities and Emerging Practices, because as Clark, I think, aptly pointed out, we are looking at the beginnings of a lot of changes in the way public agencies are designing, implementing, and managing their streets. So the material I'm going to present is the result of about a year's worth of research at the Sustainable Transportation Center at UC Davis. And this work has benefited enormously from contributions from staff at public and private organizations. And first, I want to thank all those people and recognize their contributions, because we would never have been able to put together this information without their assistance. And if there's anyone on the phone who is one of our contributors, thank you very much. And just want to recognize the help and the support from public and private organization personnel. So just to give you a little bit more information about this project, and you'll be able to get further information from the UC Davis website, and I believe that's one of the links that the webcast sponsors have provided. This is a project that's been trying to highlight connections between urban street design and sustainability, and we're doing this by documenting projects that have been built and are under construction, gaining an understanding of state of the practice and how we can start thinking about streets and sustainability and what these different relationships are. We'll look at some of those in the following slides. We're trying to understand what the state of the practice is and what additional kinds of techniques and information need to be available for people involved in design and decision making. And we're taking part in outreach and education activities like this one. So I hope that you will make a connection with the website at UC Davis Sustainable Transportation Center, and information will be added to that site over the next few months, and there's a pretty rich body of information. So the material I've put together for this presentation is very much abridged, but more project information and images on the project I'll be surveying quickly today will be available on that Davis website. If you'll advance to the next slide, slide 43, this slide provides a very basic definition of sustainable streets. And the first thing to mention is that Clark's presentation was focusing on the issue of stormwater, rainfall, snowmelt, but my interest in this issue is really in bringing attention to the multifunctional nature of city streets. So we're trying in this work to highlight both opportunities and challenges associated with a framework of a multifunctional street and street network, and how people are responding to that idea of increasing the multifunctional dimension of streets. So we're looking at the idea of sustainable streets and how we might define that, and starting off with this provisional definition, which says that sustainable streets are rights of way designed and operated to create benefits relating to movement, ecology, and community. And this definition is presented with the idea of sort of aligning with a broad sustainability agenda that looks at the three E's of sustainability, right? Environment, economy, and equity, right? So we're looking at, well, what aspects of street design kind of line up and support a broad sustainability agenda? And the project that we've been looking at really focuses on the design of the street, but we recognize that there are a lot of other opportunities for people who work with streets to address sustainability objectives, and those include construction, operations and management, maintenance and restoration techniques. So all really through the whole lifespan and different stages of the street, there are opportunities to implement sustainability objectives. And this work that we're showing you is really focused on the design phase of management of the street. So our definition suggests that there are these three themes, or Clark and I sometimes call them pillars, of movement, ecology, and community. And the next series of slides looks at, you know, the meaning of each of those in the context of street design. So if you'll advance, please, to slide 43. I'm sorry, to slide 44. This slide talks about, you know, what's the role of the street in movement? Well, this is among the most fundamental jobs of the street, right, is to function as part of a broader circulation system for movement of both people and goods. And we're interested in all on-street modes and all kinds of travel for different purposes and trips. And what one of the things that we saw in surveying different projects by a whole big range of public agencies is that there's work on street design that is not just trying to improve the environment of the street, but actually trying to create settings for improved travel performance, which usually means the street is being seen as a place to support a community that is trying to gain mode share in terms of walk, bike, transit trips, trying to reduce vehicle mile traveled and vehicle trips. So the street there is seen as part of this broader vision or attempt to change travel behavior. And we're going to talk about that more in a few slides. The next slide looks at the question of, you know, how you actually bring movement objectives into the design of the street with different features. So if you advance to slide 45, you see these two very simple boxes. It says, okay, on the left hand, we see some of the movement objectives that cities are trying to achieve and that they, you know, have in place when they're redesigning streets for sustainability objectives. So these include reliable and convenient travel and movement, reducing vehicle miles traveled, independent mobility for people who don't drive, right, youth, the elderly, people who have physical limitations, overall a high level of accessibility, and emergency vehicle access, which is one of the things Clark touched on. So you see with this list, we're getting far beyond just thinking about how the street operates in terms of ecological functions and reaching towards more of a multifunctional approach, and this would support the comments that Clark made about when you're working in the public agency context, the need to work across disciplines and across functional areas in your agency to have people from different departments and in different entities involved. So if the box on the left represents a list of objectives that you might want to achieve relative to movement, the box on the right says, well, then, you know, what's a set of features that we might see associated with street design? And the first is a highly connected and multimodal circulation network and a land use pattern that is supported by that network with mixed land uses that are close together because that's what really supports walkability. Vehicle speed that's compatible with the kind of urban place you're connecting. And then facilities for transit use, for bike use, and for walking. So those are a set of kind of basic movement features, and if you think about some other opportunities that are developing over time or that we're just seeing the beginning of, you know, we can get into some more creative and more future-oriented thoughts about street features. Clark and I saw a presentation from Washington, D.C. last week, and one of the things we noted was that they're using street space for their new shared bike program. So we're looking at the need to integrate bike storage into public street space. And there are cities that have car share programs, and they're giving over some parking space on their street for shared cars. We may be seeing storage and fueling stations, right, or charging stations for hybrid vehicles or electric vehicles in the public right-of-way. So as different technologies change, we may be working with different street features to accommodate those technologies. So there are all kinds of opportunities in the area of movement and design. If you advance to slide 46, we move on to ecology. And here is a very basic statement and actually a photo from one of the Portland projects that Clark mentioned, New Columbia, that says that sustainable streets protect and enhance natural resources and processes. So that's pretty straightforward, but there are two distinct aspects of this, and Clark focused on one of them, which is the resource value of landscape and natural elements within the right-of-way, that we can use the right-of-way space differently, and we can improve, the functioning of the whole hydrologic system with the way we treat the right-of-way space. So that's one area that's obviously receiving a lot of attention, and that's why most of you, right, logged on for the presentation today. But the second dimension of ecology with respect to street design is that there's a whole range of ecological processes that are affected by the movement system that's supported by the street. And it's something that we don't think about that much, but we're all, of course, very familiar with the fact that, vehicle operations have an enormous impact on air quality, water quality, and climate impacts. So there are a second set of ecological processes that are affected through the movement impact and movement impacts of the street, right? So if we can create streets that support places where there is a higher walk share, a higher bike share, lower per capita vehicle miles traveled, those changes are in turn going to support improvements in air and water quality and climate change interventions. So we have that kind of set of two different potentials for positive ecological benefit. If you'll advance to slide 46, I'm sorry, slide 47, that slide mirrors the earlier movement slide by looking at objectives on the left side and features on the right side. And we will be looking at a number of additional project examples for some of these features. And some of the projects we'll look at will have these features that address the direct ecological impacts of the street right-of-way, and we'll look also at some that are offering the potential to have an indirect effects rather than direct ones. So the third area is perhaps most complicated, which is the area of community objectives. And this is very much interwoven because ecology and movement goals are, of course, among community goals, just as goals for economic success and economic productivity are community goals. And the movement objectives are so fundamental to all of this. We can't have a successful community or a successful economy without having a level of mobility that's satisfying to people's needs. So, at one level, this is all bundled up, but for the purpose of discussing these design questions where, we're making these distinctions. Slide 48 identifies some of the concerns relating to community, and again, there's kind of a direct and an indirect component. So number one here talks about using the street and the design of the street and the way it's managed to contribute to social, economic, public health, cultural, and aesthetic needs, even environmental justice, which I'll touch on in a minute. And then the second is using the street to support urban development patterns that reinforce movement and ecological goals. So these are some really big aspirations, right, and things that are hard to achieve, and you may wonder, how can all of these things be addressed through the design and management of the street. So with respect to social activity and the social dimension of community, a key element there is the use of the public right-of-way for public gathering, for public events, for community functions. And one of the things we looked at was the use of street space, really, that is designed to program activity. We looked at some streets that are being modified in Cambridge, Massachusetts as community streets. This is a picture of a festival street, again, in Portland. So the public gathering and the sociability element is important from the social perspective. On the economic side, there's been a lot of interest in the use of streetscape, for example, in downtown revitalization projects, in creating business districts where We have a high level of pedestrian activity, and there has been also some work to try to quantify those values from the economic perspective, comparing the dollars spent to create and maintain these places with increases in property values and business activity. On the public health end, this is really fundamentally important, relating to traffic safety, reduced pollutant exposure, and supporting higher levels of physical activity. Cultural and aesthetic needs really address the beauty and the quality of place and the distinctiveness of the street environment. And, well, you know, the reason I put in the reference to environmental justice here is that we have, I think, a history of which we should not feel proud of making streets in some parts of our community much better designed, much more handsome, much more multifunctional than in other parts of our community. We also have a record of traffic safety that is not, you know, it's not equal for people of different incomes and people living in different neighborhoods. So one of the things that we can do is use our street programs to equalize benefits, to provide, you know, an equitable distribution of all of the positive qualities that we are creating through sustainable streets. If we go to the next slide, slide 49, we see some of the community features, and you'll be seeing examples of these that have to do with placemaking, with support for compact and infill development, again, public health outcomes and social outcomes, creating value for businesses, and reducing travel-related injuries and fatalities. And one of the things we highlight on the right side is what I call right-sizing roads. So making roads appropriate for their environments and for operating conditions, as well as making them places that can be easily crossed if their environments really want to encourage pedestrian activity and safety. So that's a whole perspective on community that is really added on to the ecological and movement functions. And what we're going to do next is talk a little bit about how these different goals actually function in terms of the mechanisms of accomplishing them. So these different features work in different ways to accomplish sustainability objectives. And I like to draw people's attention to the fact that some features in the street bring about results very directly and others don't. And when we're almost inevitably working with professionals from different disciplines, when we work on street design in this way, and there's, you know, some people are familiar with some techniques, some people are familiar with other techniques, so there's a certain level of teaching that can be very helpful, and there are also some new terms. So I want to introduce you to two terms that I use here. One is a term a lot of you are probably familiar with, which is the term catalyst. And I use the term catalyst as in the chemistry field, as external factors that are essential to producing a desired response. Those are catalysts. And the other term I use, and you'll see on the next slide, is the term complements. And complements are external factors that increase the reliability or the strength of a response. And now we'll look at two examples, and you'll see these terms in use, and hopefully they will help to illuminate some of the challenges and the opportunities in designing multifunctional streets. So if you look at slide 50, this is kind of a diagram about ecological features and ecological outcomes within the street. I'll direct your attention first to the right side of the slide, where we're looking at a list of desired outcomes. And this list includes reduced pollutant loads from urban runoff, reduced erosion, turbulence, and temperature impacts of urban runoff. So if you're ultimately focused on those outcomes as a professional concerned with the ecology of the street, you might consider using features such as those listed on the left side of the slide, pervious paving, biofiltration swales, you know, and you could continue and make a bigger list here. So what this slide is showing is that there are intermediate effects that are created by these street features, such as infiltrating runoff and stormwater on site, slowing runoff rate, removing sediment from stormwater before infiltration, and that when these features are properly designed, installed, and maintained, What these red arrows signify is that there's a direct connection to these effects, right? So this is an example of a very straightforward process of using features in new street design to lead you to desired outcomes. On the next slide, what you see is a more challenging outcome desired. And it's more challenging because it's associated with a more complicated process. So on the right column of this slide, we see the desired outcome is reduced vehicle miles traveled, increased physical activity, and then there's a whole set of benefits that are associated with that, including benefits to water quality because of the reduced emission, particulate matter, tire wear and tear, etc. That is all generated by vehicle travel on the street. So have a look at the left side of the slide, right? And it's, so what are the features, if you're a street designer, that you want, that you would think about putting into place in order to reduce vehicle miles traveled and increase physical activity? Well, you would probably focus on facilities for non-motorized transport, walk and bike, and facilities for public transit operations. But in this case, we can't put in, these big happy red arrows that go right to the outcome because there are catalysts as well as complements. So if you put in your facilities for non-motorized transport, you have to still rely on a response from the users of these facilities, right? The human beings who need to make a choice to bike or walk in order to make the presence of that facility meaningful. If you build facilities in the street for public transit, you need to have a public transit operator that actually provides a meaningful level of service on the street. And this may seem, very obvious, but I have found it really bears restating, and I'll get to why in just a moment. So those catalysts have complements, and with respect to travel by transit, by bike and walk, the complements relate to the land use pattern that is being supported by the street system. So if you put in your sidewalks and you need users to choose to walk on those sidewalks, you're going to make that choice much more likely if you're in a place where their walks can be short and convenient because places are easily gotten to by foot. And then you get the mobility outcome in terms of increasing travel by non-polluting modes and increasing travel by less polluting modes, which is how I think of transit. One of the reasons, the reason this is so important to recognize the catalysts and the complements is that in order to change travel behavior, not just to change the way the ecology of the street itself functions, efforts to design streets properly really need to be part of a much broader sustainability or smart growth effort because that's the way that these other elements start to be put into place. That concludes the sort of conceptual part of the presentation, and I'm now going to go on to showing you examples of sustainable streets, and you'll see some that have this broader approach that I'm talking about and some that are more focused on, a particular facility and the treatment of its right-of-way. So you'll see some examples that I think are very impressive. You'll see some where you might see some missed opportunities because these three dimensions of community, movement, and ecology are not being systematically integrated into these projects. There's lots and lots of agencies that are really in the early days of this work. It's very much still developing, and I'm sure you all appreciate that. And the questions we got, reflected that. This is the beginning of an emerging and new practice. So if you'll move on to the next slide, slide 62 shows four themes of sustainable streets. And these are themes that emerged from a set of about 50 examples that our research uncovered and that people were kind enough to contribute to our work. And while none of them address only a single element, there were dominant themes in most of the examples, and that led to this grouping. So the first set of projects have stormwater management as a primary design objective. We use the word plus here to convey the fact that there are additional objectives in every case, and I think there was a question about, you know, co-benefits, and you'll see some of those co-benefits, and I hope these illustrations will be helpful in providing information about that. The second set of comments and examples is oriented to context more than a specific objective, which is that these are projects in the context of higher volume streets, and there's been a lot of interest in how can we treat our larger streets to incorporate some of these ecological functions and to contribute better to community character, et cetera. So we separated out the bigger streets because there is particular interest in those. The third set focused on downtown revitalization, and in these cases, the projects are in what I call mature communities, older communities, and these places are using street design as a tool to spur economic activity and to support compact and infill development. So these are really places that have a commitment to a smart growth approach. It's a more comprehensive approach, but as you'll see, these are not projects that have a stormwater or an explicit ecological element. And then the fourth category are redesigned and new neighborhoods that are addressing these three sets of themes. On the next slide, so advance to slide 63, you'll see a list of what we call our album close-ups. So of our 50 examples that we started with, we chose about 12 that we collected detailed information for, and we had a lot of cooperation from the sponsoring agencies and the designers of some of these projects. I'm going to give you what is very much an overview of these projects, but again, I just want to repeat that there'll be additional information on all of these projects online on the UC Davis website within the next few weeks. So please follow up if you'd like to obtain additional information. So let's go on to slide 54. And this is an image of one of the Portland projects that I think Clark already mentioned. I've been using it as a divider slide, so I decided to stick with it. 12th Avenue in Portland, and this starts off our stormwater management slides, and what I wanted to mention is that when we did this survey to professionals and said, you know, tell us about how you're creating sustainable streets in a very open way, the recipients of that request most frequently associated that phrase with stormwater management projects, and most commonly that included landscaping for bioretention or biofiltration and use of pervious paving. So even though some of you may be frustrated that these ideas aren't better accepted, I'd say that of the whole web of issues related to street design and sustainability, best management practices for stormwater are the most clearly identified and developed as contributing to sustainability goals. So we got, you know, we got quite a bit of material on this topic and less on the movement and the community aims of streets. Someone had been asking, you know, where do you start? And I'm afraid that the slides on this project have sort of lost their images. But this is an example in Gresham, Oregon, of a locality taking a very modest start by working on a local street to implement a pilot project that uses different techniques. And what they've done is they've installed on three blocks of a suburban residential street porous paving in the parking strip on one side of the street and a series of three small rain gardens on the other side of the street, as well as a series of erosion and sedimentation control measures. And on the next slide, you can see a quote from one of the agency staff people who explained, you know, how they're using this approach to start off their new program of green streets. So they saw this as, you know, giving them a chance to experience design and construction on a really small scale and look at the costs, to get some environmental benefit, obviously, but also as a community education activity and an experiment which would let them get feedback from their neighborhoods. So that's kind of an example of, you know, a very small-scale effort, but a meaningful one in terms of a local government, you know, testing something out with a public awareness component as well. We also found that there was a public education component in this next project that starts on slide 57, which is from Kansas City, And I like this quote from our contributor there who said, look, you know, once we're solving one issue, let's try to solve multiple issues, you know, back to this idea of co-benefits. And this is a 7-block streetscape project on a main east-west corridor that goes through the downtown financial district, and it includes stormwater management and urban forest features, as well as a redesign of the roadway that reduced the number of travel lanes and added on-street parking. And the next slide, you can see a little close-up of the rain garden there and the, you know, new trees put in here. And this street had been very bare previously, so this is quite a change. So from this downtown setting to a residential setting, in the next example, which starts on slide 59, this is a subdivision that was designed with pervious paving and rain gardens designed fully integrated into the site design on an infill project. And the project designers were working to comply with certain requirements from the city that, if handled conventionally, would have had a significant impact on the number of units that could have been constructed. So what they were looking for was a solution that would be cost-effective from the revenue side for the project, as well as offering these stormwater and aesthetic benefits. And on slide 60, you can see the site plan for this project and see how fully the paving and landscape dimensions are integrated into this project. And the next slide, actually, I think slide 61, I have to apologize for this, it repeats the earlier text on slide 59. So let's, I'm just going to make a few concluding comments about the stormwater projects, because another type of project that we're seeing, and I don't have slides on it right here, but just to mention that we're also seeing some work where green building techniques are integrated with green infrastructure. And we have an example from Seattle, Washington, of a private development project that is also redesigning the street. And so you're seeing this fuller incorporation, green building, green infrastructure, and that's a really exciting piece of progress to look at. And again, information on that project, which is called Taylor 28 in Seattle, which was contributed by the folks at Methune, which is a Seattle-based design firm, will be available on the UC Davis website. So our next section is about these higher volume streets that I mentioned earlier. This starts on slide 62. Clark already mentioned Sandy Boulevard in Portland, which is one of the examples. So I'm just going to talk about two examples, and they're very different kinds of examples. Of the projects we received on higher volume streets, there are two types of projects that are worth differentiating. One set of projects are what I think of as remedial projects that took what I think of as absolutely awful streets and made them safe and multimodal. And that's an important kind of project given the fact that we have a lot of streets that are not safe for pedestrians and don't have, you know, basic landscaping, basic provision for, you know, safe accommodation of pedestrians or accommodation for transit. So that's an important type of project, but it can be contrasted with projects where the street is part of a vision of a different kind of city place. So I'll show you examples of one of each of those types of projects. The background of this slide is Aurora Avenue in Shoreline, Washington, which is just north of Seattle. In fact, Aurora Avenue extends into Seattle from Shoreline. And while we sometimes look for before and after pictures on the project, this sort of is an in and out because it's about 1 mile of this big street has been improved to the kind of standard you see in this photo, and most of the street is still pretty dismal. And if you go to the next slide, you can get a good sense of what I mean when I say dismal. Oh, sorry, that's one slide away. So here on, I'm now on slide 63. Sorry, let me get my bearings, that describes this project, a new design for a one-mile portion of Washington State Highway 99, very high-volume route with both transit and high truck volumes. And in the in its prior incarnation, this was one of the streets lacking basic pedestrian facilities such as continuous sidewalks. This project was undertaken with a context-sensitive solutions process. And now we look at the next slide, you can see the kinds of conditions that were in Aurora Avenue before the project. And, you know, we really have to note that these conditions persist outside of the project boundaries in both the cities of Shoreline and Seattle. And I wish I could say, I could expect that this would be a really unfamiliar kind of picture to our audience today, but I bet that lots of you come from agencies with facilities like this. And that's one of the reasons why there is so much competition for funds to improve our streets, because there are so many lane miles of streets needing attention, and because the public safety issues, justifiably really do dominate a lot of the agendas. This particular project included stormwater features as well as public safety improvements and many other elements. So it's really a very thorough undertaking and very comprehensive with respect to the right-of-way and the movement function. This project didn't attempt any changes in sort of the community function or the land use context of the street. And there are a few more, I think one more slide on this that shows you some other elements on slide 65. And then we can go to the second big street example, which is an example from Vancouver that begins on slide 66. And this is the project of our entire sample that has the highest density development context. And you can see those residential towers in the background. This is the Falls Creek neighborhood of Vancouver, and in this case, the street is being redesigned following the construction of this very high-density environment. So, you know, the street design is seen as supporting this development as a change in the street and a change in adjoining land use, and in that way, you know, it's the other kind of project very different from the Aurora Avenue project. And the next slide shows more sharply both the residential towers and also you can see the cross-section of the street. I cannot explain why there are virtually no cars on this street. But what you see here is that there's a very unusual design for this street. I call this a one-sided multi-way boulevard. The designers have put in a local access lane along the side of the street that fronts on these residential towers so that drop-off, pick-up, walking, biking, slow-moving traffic happens in this protected curb lane, and then it comes in and joins the through traffic on the center lane. So you can see the bike path there as well, and the planting strip and sidewalk on the other side. So this is a case where the street design is very much integrated in with change in land use and where there's an expectation over time that there will be, this impact on vehicle miles traveled and trip making that I talked about earlier in terms of creating an urban place that, like much of the rest of Vancouver, you know, performs very well in terms of mode shift and travel behavior. So that's our look at big streets, although one of the streets in the next category also qualifies. We're going to look next at the role of streets in downtown revitalization and some examples, and this starts on slide 68, so please advance to slide 68. And we're going to touch on three examples. All of these projects are focused on smart growth principles, in particular facilitating successful infill development, and in each of these projects, street design is used as a key element of intensification and the creation of walkable urbanism. And none of these downtown revitalization projects focus explicitly on ecological objectives, but you will see that some of them involve significant new plantings as well as reduction in impervious surfaces. But their focus is more on the community and the movement objectives of the street. The first project is part of a very major civic effort at revitalization of downtown Chattanooga, Tennessee. This is also one of our big street projects. And this project was a redesign of Chattanooga's Riverfront Parkway as well as changes to several downtown streets. And the really dramatic change that occurred here was that the city's riverfront parkway was rebuilt to change it from a limited access facility to a city street. And on the next slide, slide 70, there's a quote from one of the city staff that worked on the project, and I really like this. He says, before it felt like a highway, and now it feels like a road through a park, and he notes that the example offers good transferability, because other cities do have those ugly highways, right? It's not just Chattanooga. So this is an interesting example for anyone who wants to see, you know, how a city really remade a waterfront facility. And they did it with the addition of new intersections with city streets and the creation of a wide, they call it a promenade on the riverside of the street. And by redesigning and rebuilding the street, they have also made additional development opportunities. So they're working on stimulating economic activity and new development in the city's downtown as part of this effort. Downtown redevelopment was also at the core of the motivation for the city of San Jose in creating a downtown transit mall along its downtown streets. And the next slide is from San Jose, where there is a very unusual street design that accommodates light rail in the city's downtown along a several-block transit mall. And in this design, the light rail vehicles are actually part of the pedestrian realm. So you see there's no, you know, coming off the vehicle into the street and then to the sidewalk. You come off the vehicle directly onto the sidewalk, and the vehicles run between two rows of trees, on tracks that are between these two rows of trees. So the San Jose example is one where a city redevelopment plan that was seeking to bring jobs and housing into downtown also included redesign and rebuilding of the streets in order to support transit. So again, it's a movement focus, and if there's success with this, ultimately it will mean environmental benefits that are derived from changes in movement patterns. The next downtown revitalization example begins on slide 72. It's from Livermore, California, which is in the what I call the Far East Bay in the San Francisco Bay Area. And this is also a very unusual design. It's a design that is really focused on bringing value and activity to a downtown area, and the contributor's perspective on slide 73 expresses the designer's view that a sustainability challenge is to achieve successful relationships between people, cars, and our built environment. So this design, actually I'm going to ask you to back up to slide 72 because I think you can see how the design works a little better. What this design does is create an area that is called a flexible zone where the parking, what is usually parking space, can flex back and forth between being parking space and being outdoor dining space, space for trees, or in this case trees and architectural objects, these trellises you see, and sort of add that to the person-oriented or pedestrian-oriented space of the street. And it slows down movement on the street, and it creates space for local merchants, restaurants, et cetera, to take advantage of additional space actually in the curb-to-curb area. So this is a really innovative design, and it's a way of saying, look, we're putting all this emphasis on the quality of our environment for the community, and the movement function is kind of taking a back seat, though it does still exist. There's still through traffic on the street. The last set of projects have a neighborhood focus, and they start on slide 74. If you could advance to slide 74, please. This first slide and the next one, slide 75, are from New Columbia in Portland, and I just couldn't resist putting them in there, even though Clark already talked about it. But what I wanted to comment on is that the reason I think New Columbia is a project that is so worth noting is that the sustainability objectives were actually sort of the second tier objectives, because the first tier of objectives here were just to create a mixed income and mixed use community that was sponsored in part by the Portland Housing Authority. So this project very much represents a real comprehensive approach to smart growth, all the way from a variety of housing types and price points to these stormwater features. So it's a very exciting project and very worth learning about and visiting. I did have a chance to visit, and I was really impressed, and was a treat to be able to see it and be there. This project, which is close into downtown Portland, is contrasted with the next neighborhood, which is Pringle Creek, and Pringle Creek lies on number 76. And Pringle Creek is a low-impact development that's now under construction, where the sustainability qualities are very much part of the marketing of the project. Now, it is a sustainable community, and slide 77 is a perspective from the developer. So here they're really integrating the design with the overall marketing and identity of the total community. It was pointed out to me recently that the streets in Pringle Creek are actually privately owned as part of the development, which does actually facilitated the approval process, et cetera, and they're doing some unconventional things with the specifics of the design. The third of our neighborhood examples is a Canadian example from Calgary, Alberta. It starts on page 78. This is also a reuse example, and it's of particular interest because this is an old military property called Garrison Woods, and in the reuse of the property, the density was tripled, and one of the elements supporting the tripling of the density was a change in the street plan to greatly increase street connectivity and to uniquely design each of the streets. So the developers of this project rejected the idea of standards. We had a question earlier about, should we change our standards? These folks sort of said, well, we don't want to work to standards. We want to look at what's on site in terms of trees that should be preserved, in terms of views, in terms of access to surroundings, and we want to design the street system to be responsive of the context of the site and the development program and really make the streets individually unique. So that's really a very different approach to the street plan in this neighborhood. So with that, I'm going to just wrap up some comments on slide 8. I identify three areas where I think there's work needed and help for practitioners needed on moving ahead. One is that these objectives that we've talked about really do require some new design techniques and exploration and answer to technical questions, such as the questions asked earlier about different soil types, and those fall under my improved knowledge base. And to highlight an area that some of you may have grappled with before, for example, a lot of interest in increasing the number of trees in public right-of-ways, and there is in many communities, many agencies, been a tension with highway or street agencies about trees in the roadside and the dangers that they are thought to pose by some agencies. So we're still working on understanding, what are the dynamics, who's right in the argument about whether trees in the roadside might actually have a traffic calming function. Increasing research activity around some of these themes, I think, will shortly be available to really help folks out. And then similarly, some new planning tools. I've been experimenting with the idea of using functional classification of streets to designate different ecological priorities along with mobility priorities, and other tools that agencies can use to integrate these objectives and activities into the work of various departments. So with that, I'd like to wrap up and allow time for questions. Slide 81 has my contact information as well as the UC Davis website. And again, we'll be adding materials to that website in the next few weeks. So I'd just like to thank you very much for taking part today, and I welcome your questions or subsequent follow-up.
Thank you, Ellen. We will have time again for some questions. However, let me first draw your attention to where you can obtain the contact information for all of our speakers today. If you're online, simply click on the Home button at the top of your screen. You will be returned to the seminar's homepage, which has the speakers' email addresses and phone numbers. Please move ahead to slide 83. At this time, I would also like to point out both our link for additional resources as well as the link for our evaluation form. For those of you participating online, please take a look at the left-hand sidebar. There is a links button which has additional resources identified for today's webcast. Also on the left-hand sidebar, you should see a feedback button. Please take a quick minute or so to submit the online feedback form, as we really do value your comments as we strive to improve these webcasts. At this time, we will move on to questions, and we're going to begin with those submitted online. Our first question comes from Zora in Maryland, and the question is, a coalition of partners is at the beginning stages of developing a rainscaping social marketing campaign for Anne Arundel County. Can slides from this presentation be used for the campaign, both EPA slides and UC Davis? I'm actually going to go ahead and answer this question, and the answer is yes, you can. This presentation, along with over 30 other Watershed Academy webcasts, are available indefinitely for download at epa.gov/watershedwebcast. All that we ask is that you give credit to both the US EPA and the author of the slides that you are using. With that being said, we're going to move on to some questions for Ellen. Ellen, the first question comes from Karen in Oklahoma. On the Kansas City slide, how does the water get to the trees and rain garden? It looked like it had a curb all around it.
Okay, I'm going to transfer my attention to that slide, but what I recall is that there's actually an inlet in that curb where the water is, where the water will flow, and then there's an area that's referred to as the forebay, where debris, et cetera, can gather to then be cleaned out mechanically or by a person cleaning it out mechanically, and then there's that landscape garden. So I think you're referring to slide 58 in your question, and if you look kind of at the back of that planter box, I think it's just a question of the angle of the boxes. That's the photo on the left is the rain garden area. The tree boxes, I think, do not have a similar mechanism. So they're functioning in two different ways. So the tree boxes are just adding pervious surface without, you know, the whole filtration rain garden effect that you have in the left side.
Thank you, Ellen. The second question comes from Betty in Boston. How are the cities funding these projects? Is it all local money? Is there federal money involved?
There's a big range of funding techniques, and it's really been interesting to the extent we've been able to learn about it, and I should let folks know that the EPA is sponsoring additional research on work and work like it, and we're going to be looking into a question of the institutional arrangements and the funding. It is as varied as Vancouver reducing required parking lot construction and taking money from a developer who is going to use it for parking and instead putting it into roadway design. The city of Washington, D.C. using revenue from bus shelter advertising, and other cities, you know, applying for specific funds through state or federal sources for these individual projects. So it really runs the gamut. And again, some of these projects are very modest starts, and others are really significant, requiring, you know, ongoing revenue sources. So there's not one answer. Some of the projects on the within private developments are sort of self-funded because they are, you know, they're making the projects work financially. So there's a big range of answers, and EPA will have some more specific information on costs and revenue sources when this new project is completed.
Great. Our next question comes from Kevin in Canada. Can someone speak to the design concept of WooNerfs? And WooNerfs, I just recently learned, is a Dutch term for a slow-moving shared street. So can someone speak to the design concept of WooNerfs and how they have been successfully integrated into residential development to accommodate stormwater as well as mobility equality?
I'm not familiar with how WooNerfs have been used for stormwater, so I'll ask Clark if he's familiar with that while I make a comment, which is that what I see is that Vunarv sort of correctly look at the local street and say that on the local street the emphasis should be on community. And because traffic volumes are very low and traffic speeds should be very low, you often do have an opportunity to dedicate space to, for ecological functions, right? There's not a lot of competition for space as you have on high volume streets. So it makes sense to me that there would be an opportunity to address stormwater functions, but I have not not seen that at work. Clark, if you have anything you want to chime in with?
Yeah, I'll add to that, in that the concept of the Wunarf is very much of a European concept and not seen so much here in North America. And I've actually talked to different people in the know about that. And but you can make the direct sort of connection to things like the Chicago Green Alleys program or sort of environments like that, again, that are sort of slow-moving, providing access for vehicles, but then it's providing some open space and such. And so the use of permeable pavings are very appropriate for those types of locations. Oftentimes, in a slow-moving street, you actually kind of want to put up obstacles, you know, so that it's just not a direct cut through, and so you see some in the Japanese examples or some of the European examples of tree pits put in, you know, kind of in a pattern that would create a sort of a weaving form and such. So I think there's a great opportunity for these kind of slow-moving streets like alleys and that to have this kind of new life brought into them.
Our next question comes from Megan in Vermont. Was anything special done to allow the trees on the San Jose, California slide to function with such a small tree ring or well? I thought that one of the typical challenges with treescaping urban environments was that you had to have enough sidewalk to have enough, quote, open soil to adequately irrigate the trees and also not compact the soils too much with the weight of the pavement. I guess I am wondering if the paved surface is somehow different. Thank you.
The San Jose example is an older project. What I've seen in some newer projects is the use of structural soils that designers, I believe, are using in cases where their space is constrained. So I don't have information about the specific techniques that were used in the San Jose case, but I believe you're certainly correct in terms of, you know, this being a concern and a challenge, particularly in places where there really is a lot of demand by different users and for different functions within highly urbanized street space. Clark, do you have anything to add on that question?
Yes, I do. And I've been seeing more sort of landscape details now where the actual paving surface is essentially kind of suspended above open soil below. So there's really no compaction. So as Ellen's right, there could be the use of structural soils, which is this soil median of different size aggregates that can, you know, they can actually have some compaction put on them, but there's enough pore capacity between all these aggregates that allow for soil and water and air to get through them, so allow the roots to expand. But then there's also a design detail where there's actually a structure below the sidewalk that kind of keeps the paving above the actual planted area, and so as long as there's, you know, enough space for irrigation water and the tree trunk to come poking out of the hole, and that the caliper of the tree isn't going to be one that it gets strangled. I mean, there's some nightmare trees here on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington I feel so sorry for. But if there's a control caliper, then you don't have a compacted space beneath there. And so enough air and water gets down there, and so the roots are happy.
Great, thank you. And it looks like we have two questions that are more directed towards Clark. And the first one comes from Lauren in Louisiana. How do we get the toolbox that Northern Kentucky has?
Well, in about 5 minutes, I go back down to my desk, and I start getting back to editing that toolbox. We're hoping to have that available on our Smart Growth website by our new partners conference in January. So look for it in January.
And the next question comes from John in Maine. Why is there a storm drain on that first photo of a sustainable street?
Well, we're trying to identify which photo you're referring to, and there's the one in New Columbia neighborhood. But this brings up a good point, that these type of facilities do not replace flood control issues. This is water quality issues that are dealing with. And so the point is that you want to intercept and deal with a lot of those smaller storms, so about like 80% of those kind of smaller events that can be taken up and infiltrated into the landscape. But those bigger events, like the 5, 10, 100-year storm, you still need to have the overflow capacity that the storm drains provide.
Great. At this time, I will unmute the phone lines. So if we do have questions from the phone, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before you ask your question.
Are there any questions?
Okay, if there are no questions, this does conclude today's Watershed Academy webcast. On behalf of the entire EPA Watershed Academy webcast team, I would like to thank Clark Wilson and Ellen Greenberg for their help with this webcast. And, of course, thanks to every one of you who joined us. This is Megan Classic from the EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds signing off. Have a great day, everyone.